Welcome to Practical Defense, episode 131, an interview with Bill Herndon. Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Addix. This week, we have a guest on the show. Bill Herndon shares his experiences moving from years of practicing in a dojo to law enforcement, where he had to confront street thugs trying to hurt him. He explains the mental transition he had to make coming from years of training in the dojo, where you don't want to hurt your partner, to dealing with violent and explosive criminal attacks. He also gives us some pointers on how to train so that we, as civilians, can better deal with the shock of assaults. But before we get into that, I have to share one of my personal eye-opening experiences that I had this week. I had a dry run crisis event, and I failed miserably. Even my wonderful wife called my efforts pathetic. Yeah, it still hurts. She actually used the word pathetic and said I was not prepared at all. Ouch. I'll preface the story by saying that everything was fine in the end. No one was actually in any danger at any time, and it was just an overreaction by my brother-in-law. So here's the story. I received a call at 10 o'clock in the evening from my brother-in-law. He asked me to come over to his home immediately and watch his kids because my sister had gone out for an evening horseback ride and she was overdue. He wanted to hike the trail and look for her, but he didn't want to leave his children home alone that late at night. I asked the standard questions like how long was she overdue, did she have her gun, and so on and so forth. He didn't know how long she was overdue because he didn't keep good track of when she left. And also, she did not have her handgun. Despite being licensed for concealed carry, she was going to cross over into some areas that were clearly marked no firearms and no hunting. So, obeying the laws, she was not going to carry there. The unfortunate part is that there are still plenty of threats that she could face out there. Packs of huge coyotes. Now, our coyotes out here are the size of German shepherds. Mountain lions have been seen on a regular basis, and there's always the possibility of being thrown from a horse, and potentially even two-legged predators. So he said he wanted to go look for her for a bit, and then if he found nothing, he was going to call search and rescue. I said I'd be over right away, and we hung up. By this time, my heart was racing. I also thought to myself that there was no way I was going to be sitting at home with the kids while he went out to look for her. If she was badly hurt, one person needed to stay with her while the other went for help. It's a two-man job. So my wife pulled our youngest out of bed while I got changed for a night hike and grabbed some gear. She was going to watch all of the kids while my brother-in-law and I hit the trails. This is where it went badly. With all of my go bags, I had nothing appropriate for this event. I had family go bags for evacuating the house. I had three-day bags for each of the cars. I have food and water for a month in the event of an earthquake. I have my home defense kit, but I had nothing prepared for a nighttime search and rescue. So I scrambled to put two bags together. One was for me and the other one was for my brother-in-law because I knew that he had nothing. I used my hunting kit as a base since it was portable and I already had a trauma kit in it, rope, and some glow sticks. I wanted more glow sticks in the event that I needed to mark a trail. I wanted GPS units to record locations. There's no cell coverage in the area she was riding, so I also wanted my handheld ham radios, and, you know, so on and so forth and things like that. I got a lot of things together very quickly, but not some of the most important things. I could only find one ham radio and none of my GPS units. I hadn't checked the batteries in my flashlights recently, so I just grabbed a handful of batteries and threw them in the bag, figuring that if a flashlight died, I could install new batteries on the trail. The whole process took me 10 minutes. I gave up on the GPS units and the second ham radio and literally was setting the house alarm and walking out of the door when I got a call that my sister was home safe and sound. It was a complete false alarm. She was home on the schedule that she had set, and it was just a miscommunication between her and her husband, and he can overreact at times. I thought I'd done pretty well, but my wife said that I took too long. It was 10 minutes my sister could have been lying in a ditch or hanging from a cliff. I need something I could grab and just go. Literally, boots, pants, bag, in the truck, gone. So that was my crisis test run, and I failed. Pathetically. What I'm going to do now is convert my hunting kit into my search and rescue go bag. When I go hunting, I'll just pull out what I don't need and set it aside. Half of what's in there is going to stay there anyway, so it's a good base. It was a good test only because it was spontaneous, real, and fortunately, completely uneventful. What happened last Wednesday is what we call a learning opportunity. It was a bit painful, but not as painful as it could have been. Okay, enough of that. Next, I'll play the interview with Bill Herndon right after the break. But before we get to it, I want to emphasize that you should pay close attention to Bill's comments. Sometimes they're subtle, but there's some real wisdom from experience in there. I missed them during the interview, so I didn't get a chance to ask follow-up questions. However, if you're attentive, you can pick up some really interesting insights. And with that, we'll be right back with our interview with Bill Herndon after the break.
England, Wales, Scotland, Australia, Canada, and 12 other industrialized and largely disarmed nations have higher violent crime rates than the U.S. This is according to a Dutch Ministry of Justice multinational survey. According to that survey, England and Australia are twice as vicious as America, with higher rates of robberies, muggings, and assaults. Switzerland, a well-armed nation, has a violent crime rate about the same as ours. Disarmed countries are dangerous countries, and America's few disarmed cities are the most dangerous in the Union. This is no coincidence. Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
So, this week with us, we have Bill Herndon, who is a martial artist and a former law enforcement officer. And Bill is also the president and founder of Piranha Gear, a manufacturer of training and mixed martial arts gear. So, thanks for coming on, Bill.
You're very welcome, Alex. I'm very honored to be here.
We definitely appreciate all your time. I know you're a busy guy.
Well, that's what it's like when you have a company, but a lot of people are busy.
The reason why I asked you on the show is for your background, not so much as a martial arts gear guy, but as a martial artist. You actually have a unique background, I think is very interesting to our listeners, in that you've been a martial artist most of your life, and then at the same time, you also went into law enforcement. And this is something that's very interesting to our listeners, because you were a martial artist first, and you trained in a dojo, and then had to make the transition to the street and dealing with criminals. And that's something that we're very, very interested in hearing about.
Okay, well, I think you'd mentioned I should run through my background with martial arts real quick to give you an idea, or your listeners an idea. I started with Kempo with Bob White down in Southern California in 1980 when I was in high school. Makes me feel old thinking about it. And I went on and did a bunch of Aikido, a little bit of Shotokan, a bunch of smatterings of other stuff. And then when I ended up in law enforcement, I did a variation of Aikido called Koga, which is like Aikido, except the final move is putting handcuffs on, you can think of it as. And then I eventually found my way back with a smattering of Tai Chi and Qigongs and all that stuff in the middle. And then I found my way back to Kempo. And that's what I've been back to Kempo for probably, 8 or 10 years. So I guess that's about 30 years all mixed up in there somewhere.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've started with American Kempo and moved away and came back to American Kempo as well. So I definitely know that path.
Well, it always seems like every time I did a different style, I think, yeah, but that's just not quite right, because I'm always thinking back to the first style I learned. And I imagine a lot of people go through that.
Yes.
It's just not quite right unless it's the first style you learned, because that's kind of home.
I had a very hard time initially in Hapkido, which is a very soft art. And some of the people that I trained with were familiar with American Kempo, and they kept telling me to stop thinking and moving like a big Hawaiian man and think like a small Korean man, especially when it came to the finesse moves. You know, I'd be in the middle of doing a practice and technique, couldn't remember the ending, and I'd just do a Kenpo move, and they say, stop that.
Yeah, well, I think anyone that's done more than one style has probably been there. Although I have to say, going from stand-up to ground, which I consider Aikido more of a grappling ground style, that wasn't too much of a transition. And I was actually, for a while there, I was doing Aikido and Shotokan at the same time. And that wasn't too hard, but moving the transition, like leaving Shotokan and going back to Kenpo, really trying to widen or narrow my stance back up, that was a really tough adjustment. So, you know, over time, you kind of adapt without realizing it, I guess.
Yeah, you'd have to, because the moves are designed for a certain body position, and it kind of forces you into that. Otherwise, you don't do it properly.
Well, otherwise, it's not really a style. It's just a bunch of punches and kicks, right?
Yeah, which I guess everything boils down to, which is what we teach in reality-based. Just a bunch of punches and kicks.
A kick is a kick and a punch is a punch. Yeah, that's. Although everyone does go through that phase where you think it's a lot more, and then after a while you go, well, gosh, a punch is a punch and a kick is a kick. And then, of course, I think the other thing that you were interested in our original discussion was I do have a background in law enforcement. I became a reserve deputy sheriff with the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office, and I did that for about 9 years, and I did it full-time for about a year. And I really liked being with the sheriff's office, especially as a reserve in my category, because I got to do a lot of different things. So I wasn't just working patrol that whole time. So I did get to do a lot of things, although patrol was really my first and true love with all of that. And here's my disclaimer. I don't want to claim to have to be the be-all, end-all, grizzled veteran who has seen everything, because I'm sure there are guys that work in the departments in New York and Chicago that do way more in a month than I did in all my years with law enforcement. So the only difference I think I had was, I started in martial arts and did it for so long, and I didn't get in any fights through my adult life until I got into law enforcement. So I did go through this long period of time adapting my, my thought process, my muscle memory to martial arts, and I didn't really use it for a long, 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 long time. So when I started law enforcement, it was suddenly I was using this stuff that even fighting in point tournaments just not the same as being in the real world with real people with real knives that are not made of rubber but actually sharp. It's a different kind of thing.
Yeah, well, let's focus on that, because one of the big concerns about the listeners is that we spend all our time training in a dojo on mats, and our goal is to pick up skills, but at the same time, not hurt our partner.
Exactly.
And so we hold back quite a bit. We do them fast, we do them strong, we do them hard, but we do them shallow. And in some styles, we don't even touch at all. In Hapkido, it was very soft. I mean, if anybody, thumped somebody by accident, it was like, oh, I'm sorry, are you okay? And I was like, wow, because, American Kenpo, we really whack each other. And now if somebody from Hapkido went to a single American Kenpo class, they would have freaked out. So when I was initially whacking people, they were like, Alex, stop, you're hitting too hard. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
No, but nothing's broken. It wasn't that hard.
No, but it was shocking to them. But that's part of the concern, is that we're used to this soft, don't hurt our partner. And the saying that we have, especially in firearms, is that when you train and the crisis happens, you don't rise to the occasion. You fall back on your training. And if we train to be soft and gentle, the concern is, are we going to be gentle against a criminal? And what I wanted to talk to you about is that you made that transition. You made the transition from years in the dojo to years facing real criminals. So what was that like for you?
Well, it was interesting because I vividly recall the very first instance where, because I was probably, I must have been with the department, at least 2 months on the street. Admittedly, that was during training, so it was a couple times a week kind of thing. I was probably there for, it seemed like a while, and I was getting almost cocky thinking, oh, well, I'm just good at the verbal judo thing. I won't have to fight people because I'm so good at talking them out of it. And I recall the first time of the realization that no matter what I do or say, within the next 10 seconds, we're going to be in a fight, because this is clearly not going to end well. As the melee ensued, I remember vividly having to mentally cross wires in my brain saying, no, 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 I'm supposed to punch hard now. I'm not supposed to, you know, go easy. I'm not supposed to do something and say, is that too hard? I'm not supposed to do that. And it was a transition for me. It's sort of like the only analogy I can think of is using a garden hose. And you know how you have the different settings on the garden hose?
Uh-huh.
You know, one's the spray and one is the drip and one is the full. So I felt like I consciously had to change the setting to full. That transition did not take very long. It's not like I was 30 seconds into the fight and thought, wow, I need to hit harder. You know, we're talking really a fraction of a second.
Okay, because that was... That was going to be my question was, did it slow you down?
It probably did initially. It probably slowed me down. I think my immediate reaction was a little slower because I felt like I had to kind of change gears. But I think there's also a difference in that the vast majority of the times I was doing law enforcement and we used to call it going hands-on, I very rarely had any sort of adrenaline rush during the fight. It always seemed very calm, cool, and collected as far as, you know, this is just what I'm doing. And I have very little doubt that a big part of that was the martial arts training. So I was almost detached from it, not literally, but I felt like I wasn't, you know, the classic, they call it the fog of war kind of thing. It wasn't, but I was never in a shooting. I never had anyone shooting at me. I understand that's different. But in the grappling sessions that I had to be involved in, I never really had that huge mind-altering adrenaline thing. The only analogy I can think of for that is if you're doing something and you know how when you bang your toe against the coffee table in the middle of the night and everything else shuts down and you're focused on, oh, that hurts. So you're really, everything else is gone and you're just focused on that injury. I didn't really experience that. I was still really aware of my surroundings. And I think that's because of the martial arts training. It made it so that it was less stressful than it would have been. Because for most people, the idea of just being in close contact with someone else, you know, we all have that little space bubble around ourselves that's a cultural distance.
Yes.
And breaking through that barrier, and it sounds odd because you'd think, well, the things that you're practicing that are going to pay off are the punches and kicks. And yes, that's, you know, obviously very true, but just breaking that space barrier, because that really kind of freaks people out to be that close to them. And most of the time in law enforcement, if you were dealing with someone that had not been in a lot of fights, you could tell because just being close to them really put people off. It really threw them off balance mentally. And people with a martial arts background, I didn't see that kind of thing. And you could tell, you'd like to think that most people doing law enforcement would have a martial arts background, but a surprisingly small number of them did. So it was very obvious when you get into one of these big fights and there's five bad guys and eight deputies, and you're thinking, oh, well, so three of us know how to fight.
Jeez.
The other ones are kind of hanging back, figuring out what to do. And I think that's largely because of the martial arts training.
Okay, now I want to take a couple of steps back. When you mentioned the lack of adrenaline rush and fog of war, I've actually experienced some of that myself, but in very different conditions. And I never considered it part of the martial arts training that helped me with it. In my particular case, it was while horseback riding several times. Horseback riding, people don't understand, is actually quite dangerous. And we used to go riding in the hills through Griffith Park, and I even did 10-day horseback safari across Kenya in Africa. We were out on horses in the middle of nowhere, literally 3 days from the nearest road, running through wildebeest and zebras and giraffes and elephants and everything else. I mean, really going through the herds themselves and rubbing shoulders with them.
So you were really doing the all out there, doing backflips on the horse and stuff, right?
No, I was firmly planted on the back of my little Somalian pony.
No, I meant the horse and you were doing a backflip, no?
Not
that advanced.
No,
it's
no.
The front flips that are tough, I understand.
Yes. I mean, and there were situations where we're going at a, you know, the guide would say, okay, everybody, controlled canter. And it was like the running joke was then we'd all take off at a gallop.
Well, it depends on how long the horse's legs are, I guess. Huh?
These Somalian ponies were amazing. They had the most endurance of any animal I've ever ridden in my entire life. But anyway, there were situations where the horse would fall into a crevasse, or there were cases where we're going full bore and we're all lined up going across the field, and there was no place for me to go. And all of a sudden, there was this huge hole in the ground. And my first thought was, holy crap, I'm going to crash. But the horse saw it as well. And because I used to compete in the hunter jumper class of horseback riding, so I've jumped before. So I got myself in the jumping position. The horse just naturally jumped over it.
Which does highlight the advantage of having a horse rather than a Jeep.
Yes. In certain situations. Now, during those crisis situations where the horse was falling, the horse was getting caught, we were coming up on something that if the horse had tripped, we would have both gone tumbling at 35 miles an hour onto hard rock in the middle of the African plains. I would have had to gone out, either hiked out or crawled out, you know, for several days. I mean, we were literally away from everything. I didn't feel the adrenaline rush until about 2 minutes afterwards. So during the immediate crisis, there was this calm. And then afterwards,
and you're just dealing with the situation,
just dealing with it. And then afterwards, when it was done, then the adrenaline hit. Then I started to feel sick. Then I started to get the shakes. But it wasn't actually during the immediate crisis. And it sounds very similar to what you experienced.
Well, the only time that I experienced that would be after gun stuff, where you're taking your gun out and pointing it at somebody and you're going, I'm going to shoot you unless you do what I say. And most police officers, when they do that, are like me. You're not bluffing. You're really saying, no, really, I'm not going to warn you again. I'm just going to shoot you next time. And I would get that rush after those situations, after backup has arrived and after they're cuffed and pulled out of the car or whatever the situation was. So I would get it then, but I didn't usually get it after fights. Oh, and I did leave out one other thing. In high school, I did do wrestling as well. And that actually, that and the Aikido probably served me best in law enforcement.
Yes. So one of my judo instructor actually is as a retired CHP officer, California Highway Patrol, for those not in California. And he said that everything that he did was containment. So he never used anything but judo in all of his arrests. But also the other point that I wanted to bring up is about the closeness of the body and how it throws people off. This is something I brought up on previous episodes and how it's very, very important to get used to being close, because the conflicts happen very, very close in. And you can always tell the white belts and the more experienced people because they're always doing the techniques at arm's length. And it keeps saying, no, get in. You've got to get in closer. And you're working with the white belts and the yellow belts to get them in closer because they don't want to break that bubble. I thought I was good close in and had a good experience in getting close to people and working closely. I didn't, compared to jujitsu and judo people. It was even after my 2 decades of stand-up experience, moving to the ground and having a guy, big hairy man, lay on top of you, and you get a face full of chest hair and all that other nasty stuff that happens, it's different.
Yeah.
It's really different.
That's the part of the breaking the personal barrier bubble, because I'm sure there are places out there where people get in fights and they just do the stand-up boxing match until one of them gets knocked out and falls down. We know it happens. Vast majority of the time, certainly every fight I was ever involved in law enforcement, and I can't remember anywhere I showed up after the fact because it got that bad that they called the police, where it didn't end up with people rolling around on the ground. And once you start rolling around on the ground, if you haven't done that before and you haven't been that close, it is difficult. But there is one other thing that I realized as we were talking, and I'm sure it probably had a lot to do with the delayed effect of the adrenaline, and that is when you fight in tournaments, and it doesn't matter whether the tournament's points barring or semi-contact or full contact or whatever. When you're doing the tournaments, just like I used to compete in doing law enforcement, I used to be on the shooting team and all that. And I used to love it because I felt like it was giving me great preparation for the real world. Because just like the real world, when you're competing in a tournament or when you're competing on the gun range, when that timer goes off and it goes beep, you know you can't say, oh, I kind of fumbled on my holster. Can we start the time over again real quick? And it's just like down on the street. You can't say, oh, time out, let me get back in my car and put my seatbelt on and we'll start again. That's not an option. So it's the same thing with tournaments. You're face-to-face with someone else. The judge says, go. You can't, oh, wait, I forgot to put my mouth guard in. No, you're going. And to me, the significant part was there's no take-backs. There's no redos. This is it. This is the moment that counts to varying degrees. You know, whether it's just advancing in the tournament or, you know, you're trying to get the knife out of the guy's hand. You can't start over again. And that practice is probably paramount to being able to work through that, not having the adrenaline rush immediately give you the fog of war, but you just go about your business and this is just what you're going to do. So while you need to have the mechanics of throwing punches and kicks, it's using them in that situation where you can't start over that is so different. So I think if you were just lined up in row after row in the dojo, doing your punches and your kicks, and then you expect to run out on the street and do it for real, I don't think that's going to happen, because you're going to be in that frozen, locked up, vapor lock kind of position, and you're not really sure what to do, and this is happening really fast. And I think it's easy to get caught in that vicious circle of, I'm scared and I'm thinking about that I'm scared and I should be thinking about this guy running at me, but I'm thinking about I'm scared and I shouldn't be thinking about that I'm scared, but I'm still thinking I'm scared. And I'm you know, well, now you're stuck in that vicious circle and you're not thinking about what's in front of you. And I think the tournaments or the competition gets you past that. You know, so I think that someone, even if they just did competition training and shooting, singing competition where you stand up in front of the audience and you got to start singing, you can't say, oh, can we start over again? That part is really helpful to getting past that, basically the stage fright. That makes sense?
Absolutely. And in fact, that just leads me right into the next topic, which is, what do you recommend as a training? You know, how would you...
To best prepare for fighting for real?
Yes. Thank you for helping me get that out.
You got to compete. I think that's a really admirable part of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu right now. Talking to a lot of people that I get to talk to every day, is they still seem to be really adamant that you cannot progress in the style without going to tournaments. So there are a lot of tournaments because there's a lot of people that need to compete. So they get that taste of stage fright. Whereas a lot of styles, and when we both know there are styles out there where someone can obtain a black belt and they've really never sparred.
Yeah.
Certainly never sparred anyone they don't know. And that's kind of going to give you a false sense of confidence, I think. I know there are some styles, which I'm going to leave unnamed, where they only fight tournaments with people in their own style. That's another example where you know what the other person's going to do then, and it's still pretty predictable. So I think it's vital that you get experience in a situation where you are going against an unknown and you can't start it over. And that usually ends up being competitions, like tournaments and whatnot. And I don't think it matters whether it's full contact or not either, because it's more of that you can't start it again.
Yeah, actually, I did an entire episode as for tournaments as training devices, and you're reiterating exactly what I brought up on that episode.
Yeah, well, lucky on that one, huh?
Yeah.
So you won't have to edit this out.
No.
I'm not discounting. You do need to know the mechanics of shifting your balance, stepping out of the way of the line of attack, blocks and punches and parries, and everything like that. I'm kind of assuming that people are working on that to begin with, because you have to have that as muscle memory. If you have to think about doing the technique, it's too late. You know, when you're sparring with someone, as you well know, you can't say, they're about to step forward and throw a rear leg kick. I should step in or step to the side real quick, and I can do a reverse punch to the body. Because by the time you thought of it, the moment has passed. So you have to have it so that it's happening so quickly you don't have to think about it. The equivalent firearms being, which I always go back to with my law enforcement, is drawing your gun. You can't think about how you unsnap your holster. That it's too much of a distraction and it's slowing you down too much. That part all has to be happening automatically. So the punches and kicks and shifting your balance, that all has to happen automatically. Whether or not you're doing a different type of style, I mean, in my mind, they really just break down to stand-up styles and grappling styles. And, of course, everyone that does each style is sure that their style is the best and has everything that is needed for the balanced diet kind of idea. Yeah, everything you need is in our system. They all say that. But I think everyone pretty much knows that can't be the case. You can't specialize in everything. So I don't know, is that enough to say fight in tournaments? That's probably the best thing you can do to prepare for on the street.
Okay, that sounds great. Yeah, because I've actually experienced exactly what you're talking about saying, oh, this person's going to do this and this and this, and then try and react to it in time. After my last major knee injury, I took about 10 years off from my training. And when I went back, I still had all this experience and from all my tournament time and all my years of training, but I was slow. So when I would spar in class, this is when I picked up Hapkido, I would spar in class with people that were very good and very fast. I could actually stand across from them, see them move. It would go through my head, oh, they're going to do this, this, and this, and this. Yep, that's what they did. And I could see it. I could predict it. I could see it coming, but I couldn't react.
You just couldn't move fast enough.
Because yeah. I was thinking about it, and it was just like, I knew exactly what they're going to do to me. And I was like, yep, that's what they did to me as I got clocked in the head. I was still thinking. I wasn't just moving.
Well,
they call it Mushin? Mushin?
Mushin. Yes, Mushin. Mushin. Yeah.
It's moving and reacting without thinking. And you need that in a real confrontation.
And that's what, in my mind, that, in my experience, that's what marks a lower belt from a brown belt. So by the time you reach brown belt, you should have that, if for sparring purposes. I'm thinking primarily stand-up arts. I think that happens faster with grappling styles because you have an advantage of an additional sense, which is your body's sense of touch. So you're not relying almost entirely on your sense of sight. So I think that happens faster with grappling styles. And I also think, oddly, it happens faster in grappling styles because they actually get more practice. Because in stand-up styles, even when you're sparring between rounds, you're not sparring. If you're doing a grappling style, most of the schools, you're grappling most of the time. Both the classes might last for an hour, but in one of the classes, you were actually doing stuff for 45 minutes. In the other class, well, you were doing warming up, you were kicking, you were stretching. But you were also standing there listening. You were standing, getting ready to fight the next guy or whatever. It seems like more happens in the grappling styles. Maybe that's just my personal experience. But
no, I agree. Because I do back-to-back classes. I do an hour of Kenpo and then immediately followed by an hour of Jiu-Jitsu afterwards.
I would expect that Mushin stuff to be happening faster than the well-qualified brown belt stage in a grappling style.
Yeah.
But that does lead into another thing I was thinking, and that is while tournaments are great training, the kicking and punching that you need to know so that you do it automatically, as we're talking about, without thinking about it, and it happens fast enough, and as you were saying, you could see the thing coming, but you couldn't move fast enough to get out of the way. The other thing I noticed about the street that was painfully obvious, and even though you can say it and think it, but until you're there, it doesn't really dawn on you how important it is. You're not standing on a mat, and you're not warmed up, and there's no background music to tell you what's about to happen. So suddenly, and this seemed to be half the time, if not more often, I was pretty good at seeing it coming, so I would kind of be ready for it, that, ooh, this is about to turn to poop. But you're not. You're standing on the, you know, on the worst, standing on the side of a freeway. And now it's not just about you and the other guy, the bad guy that you're fighting. You also have to worry about being pushed out into the freeway, or the fact that you're not on flat ground. It's a gravelly surface, or you're on a hill, or worst case, you're usually in someone's house and you're stepping over piles of magazines and grandpa's got the oxygen tube running and the oxygen line's getting all tangled up in your legs and there's cats and little kids and lots of obstacles. So it's not nearly as clean and neat as you grab the top of their wrist, you bend their wrist, you put your arm in their armpit and you do an arm bar to the ground. Yeah, you can't do that because there's a wall in the way. So you have to be able to adapt, and that's where knowing the techniques inside and out pays off so well, because you can start doing one technique, go, oh, there's a wall or a door jam there. or my partner's standing there. I have to adapt right now and turn it around and do the alternate, bend his elbow back into his shoulder and take him down on his back instead of what I was planning on doing. So that's where technical competence pays off, but you still have to be able to adapt because it just, oh my gosh, it seems like you're never in a good position. All you can do is not be in a bad position to block something or to start a takedown technique, which makes you kind of walk funny when you're ready for it to start, but everyone that's watching knows what you're doing.
So interesting. So since I'm a Kenpoist as well, did the grafting that we were taught in American Kenpo, do you think that helped?
Grafting is exactly what you were doing because you would start a technique and realize, literally, I can remember doing this vividly, planning on using an armbar to take someone down, and that in that particular technique, you're spinning the person to the ground usually, in the best case scenario, and starting to spin as I'm turning, I see out of the corner of my eye, oh, there's a khaki uniform standing there. I can't go that way because this is going to run this person's head into their chest or stomach, and then it's not going to work as a technique, and it's not going to make my partner happy because I didn't know my partner was standing there. So all of a sudden, I have to go into another technique where, in this particular case, where you basically bend their arm and their wrist back towards their shoulder and take them down onto their back. And fortunately, I hadn't gone far enough into the arm bar that I wasn't able to reverse it. But you know, that kind of stuff happens a lot where you have to adapt in the middle of the technique to something else. And that's where it really pays off if you know all the techniques. Because it's, to me, it was always like a trigger. You know, someone would throw a punch and I would automatically think the next three techniques that would do that appropriate defense technique. But that meant if you were in the middle of one, you could right away just change it into another. That was tremendously helpful to be able to adapt in the middle. And that comes from just the practice in the dojo. That's not necessarily the tournament stuff. And, you know, truth be told, the tournament stuff is not especially realistic as far as the actual fighting goes. At least I didn't feel like it was. I felt like, especially, most of my tournaments were all point sparring. And it was really, you go in, you throw some punches and kicks, and you come back out and see if anyone got a point kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's really what it trains you to do. And I was never really wild about that because I thought it was so unrealistic. But it does get that stage fright thing. So it's definitely worth it from that point alone.
Now, it's interesting that you bring up the fact that you liked having three or four techniques for the same type of thing. Because in American Kenpo, again, I'm going back to that since that's something that we've both done. Yellow belt and orange belt techniques, you are taught, out of the 24 techniques, there are 16 for a reverse punch, a right reverse punch. And you like the fact that you had all these various options that you could use depending upon the situation.
Well, not necessarily 16.
Because there's a theory, and someone brought this up on the Gun Rights Radio Network message boards, is that there's a theory, a learning theory, that too many options slows you down. Too many options makes you choose, and that thought process makes you vulnerable. Because there's that pause. Oh, wait, which one of the 16 do I use now?
Which one will work best? I can certainly see that argument, but my experience has been that you really have two or three favorites, and those are the ones that you're going to do by default. And knowing the others, basically you're switching to the others, at least my experience was, you switch to the other because things are already screwed up. Like, oh, I was planning on doing that arm bar. Oops, I can't, even though I've already started it. Okay, I'm already messed up now. So if I don't have another technique, I'm really screwed. What am I going to do? I'm going to wrestle them to the ground with really no technique whatsoever. But on the other hand, I know this doesn't win points in a lot of styles, in a weird way of saying, but the studio I'm at now really emphasizes keeping it simple. And a lot more emphasis on, you know, getting your body out of the way of the attack and moving when possible, as opposed to, and now we're going to learn a jump spinning rear hook kick. Would you even use that in a tournament? You would use that when you're out of range, just so the person thinks you might do that. But honestly, every time I was in a tournament, 98% of the time I got scored, it's like the same five techniques. So you just got to learn the bejeebus out of those same five techniques. The other stuff, that's fun, that's nice, you know, learn it for your belt, learn it for your task, but really, are you going to use that? No. At least that's been my experience, especially because a lot of the techniques, you know, they got like 8 or 9 movements in them. Nothing goes as planned for 8 or 9 movements. It has to be short and sweet. The other thing to keep in mind is you lose that manual dexterity when you're under stress. I personally didn't experience that, but I had talked to other deputies that did, so I can only assume that it is an issue for people. And that
is that because you didn't lose it because of your training and repetition?
I think I didn't lose it because I didn't have that adrenaline rush thing going. I think that because the deputies that I talked to that did fumble around, the classic is putting handcuffs on someone, because it does take a surprising amount of manual dexterity to put handcuffs on someone. And you do it a lot and you get used to it, but you still have to be able to move your fingers out of the way at the right time. You move them out too early, the handcuffs fall off. You move it out not soon enough and your thumb's going to get stuck in the way and the handcuffs aren't going to close, kind of thing. So I would see, especially with the newer deputies, they'd have trouble getting handcuffs on. I knew they could put the handcuffs on under normal circumstance, but they're all stressed and they're amped and they're having trouble with that manual dexterity. They just can't get their hands to work the right way, which to me translated in for purposes of our discussion, you can't do techniques that require on a lot of very subtle movements, which Aikido really comes to mind because there is a lot of subtlety to a whole lot of Aikido movements. And if you're depending on doing 5 or 6 subtle movements in a row in a fight on the side of a freeway on the gravel surface where you're sliding down the hill, you're going to be lucky to get 2 moves into it before you got to adapt and do something else. It just, in my experience, there's just no way you could do all those things, and you'd have to adapt. You know, I remember doing a particular technique. My first experience was grabbing hair. That didn't work because usually when you're in a fight with someone in law enforcement, they're drunk, they're high, or they're crazy. It's one of those, and they're always sweaty. They're not always bigger than you, although it always seems like it. And I tried to do a hair grab on someone. Well, in the dojo, those hair grabs work fantastic because you reach up and you grab the back of their head and you kind of intertwine your fingers into the hair, get a good feel, and then you pull back on the head and it works great. You know the type of techniques I'm talking about, I assume?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I decided I was going to do that. The guy had pretty long hair. It seemed like the perfect opportunity. So I reached up to grab in and woo, he's sweaty. There's no way I'm going to grab any of that hair, you know, with his hair mousse or whatever he had in there. That wasn't happening. So I had to transition right away to, okay, I got to grab the side of his neck and the trapezius and pull him down that way. So there was a momentary pause when I had to readjust to a different technique. But if I didn't know how to do the alternate, which was grabbing, you know, the top of his trapezius instead of his hair, what would I do? I'd have to jump on his back or, you know, do the Three Stooges thing or something. So you have to know multiple techniques for the same thing. Just have a couple of favorites, and those are what you practice all the time, I guess. Is that a easy, short answer?
Absolutely. In fact, I force people to do that because I keep my hair so short, no one can do a hair grab technique on me. So everyone always has to go for the jaw hook, the nose hook, or the eye hook doing those techniques.
I never tried it on someone with a big, long ponytail, which could be a man or a woman. But after that first attempt, I vowed I will never try and grab hair again because it was an abysmal failure the first time, and I was lucky people weren't hurt. So I think it's good to know a lot of techniques. Just have your favorites.
Okay, great. Well, I think that pretty much covers everything. And again, I really appreciate you taking the time out to share your experiences with us, because I know it's going to be valuable for our listeners.
Well, worth every penny, right?
Yeah. And the show is free.
Well, Alex, you do a good show. I have not listened to every show, but I have listened to quite a few, and you do a good job.
Thank you.
You deserve a bow there, too.
I appreciate it. Okay, Bill.
Well, enjoy the rest of the day.
You too. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Hello, Daniel Shaw here. I'm the host of Gunfighter Cast. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about my show and myself to see if you want to give us a download. I'm an active duty U.S. Marine infantryman with over 13 years as an end user and a trainer. Don't claim to know it all. I don't claim to have it all figured out. But what I do know, I do my best to share with my listeners in every show. via topics that I come up with, or just listeners send me emails and ask questions. I'll answer those for them, just so we can all just share our knowledge. And my listeners do a great job of giving knowledge back to me. So it's a learning experience for me just as much as it is for you. What GunfighterCast is, it's a sometimes weekly podcast that covers everything from basic shooting skills to mindset, and I try to do a few gear reviews. If you want a podcast that covers firearms-related politics or the latest trends and what so-and-so gun manufacturer is coming out with soon, then you're probably going to be disappointed when you listen to my show. But if you want to hear about shooting, training, and all things pertaining, then GunfighterCast might be worth a download. Whether you're a novice that's just getting started, or you're an old salt that's been in the game for many years, I try to give a little something for everybody. If you're interested, just go on iTunes, and you can search for GunfighterCast up there in the search bar. Point you right to me. You can download each episode, put it on your iPod, or listen to it right there. Or if you don't do the iTunes thing, you can set your RSS feeds to bring them in and be updated whenever a new show comes out. And if that doesn't work for you, you can just go to www.gunfightercast.com, and you can listen right there through your web browser or download the shows through your web browser. And if that's still not good enough for you, then become a member, which is the one I recommend. Become a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network forums, and you can listen to all the shows right there through my little section of the forums under GunfighterCast. And you can also interact with me and interact with all the other listeners, and we're just one big information and skill-sharing happy family. So I hope to have you with me on my next show and from then on. But until then, GunfighterCast promo out.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
Thanks again, Bill, for coming on the show and sharing your experiences with us. One point that I'd like to emphasize that I didn't get a chance to during the discussion was about personal space sensitivity. Bill brought it up as an issue and how it could shock people and make them freeze or at least pause in a crisis. I've also mentioned this on several shows over the years, and it's a serious issue and something that you need to overcome. Now, the point I wanted to make is that there is another level of sensitivity that I was not aware of until I started grappling. Through my years of training, I thought I had completely eliminated my bubble. But it turns out it was only from a standing perspective. I wasn't even aware that there was another bubble that you had when you're on the ground. But there is. It was really strange, and for the first few times it happened, I was really uncomfortable, and it surprised me. I thought I was past all of that. I believe the difference comes from the weight. When you're standing, you're only brushing up against the other person, but you don't feel their body weight. Now, when you're grappling, the closeness plus the body weight is what I think makes the difference. You also sometimes wind up positions that you normally reserve for your significant other, and the whole thing can be really disconcerting until you get used to it. And the time to get used to it is not when you're in a life and death struggle. So through my personal training, I've discovered that there are two different types of bubbles. There's the stand-up bubble, and then there's the grappling bubble. And to be truly prepared, you need to build up a resistance to both. And finally, I referenced an episode where I discussed tournaments as training devices during the interview. I looked it up, and it was way back in episode 28. Paul Wilson of Karate Cafe joined me for that particular topic. And it's still worth a listen, so go and check it out. Okay, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for stopping by and downloading this episode. You can find a link to Bill's company, Piranha Gear, in the show notes. It's also easy to remember. Just go to piranhagear.com. And as always, don't forget that we have a 20% discount on subscriptions to Taekwondo Times magazine. Just enter our exclusive promo code of PRACDEF01 at checkout. The subscription to the print edition of the magazine includes digital copies as well. You can find a promo code and a link in the show notes. If you have any tips you would like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware and stay safe.
Tom Gilmore lives on a farm. There's a storm on the way, so he's boarding up the windows of his house.
Haley Williams lives in an apartment. It's a beautiful day. She's making her usual monthly donation to the American Red Cross.
Tom doesn't know a tornado will leave his family with no place to go.
Haley doesn't know her gift will help give Tom's family shelter.
When you support the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Practical Offense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com.